and the supernatural, the popular ballads, in bracket, some 30 in number, bracket close, concerning Robin Hood and his merry men, are a class by themselves. Robin Hood is, in Albert C. Bow's words, the people's counterpart of aristocratic heroes like Sir Zavian, Zawain. He is honest and God-fearing, but bosses over the robs, the cruel rich, to mitigate the penury of the poor. The most popular ballad dating from the Nut Brown Mad, and the edition in which a spectator brought out the beauties of Chevy Chase's. Chevy Chase's is caused in the traditional ballad meter referred to above, but the Nut Brown Mad is written in a stanza in 12 lines each. Along with the ballads in the 15th century, there was a great outpouring of lyric verse dealing with both religious and secular themes. Versification. As regards versification, all the poets of the 15th century looked back to Chaucer for guidance. Very few new prosodic forms were adopted by them. In fact, instead of advancement, the prosodic part of English poetry showed sign of restoration, if not outright descendance. Very few poets seems to have had an ear for music. Chaucer was perhaps the first English poet who instinctively grasped the hidden music of English word. But 15th century Chaucerian did not benefit from the shining example before them. Much confusion and disharmony were created when the final was dropped in the 15th century that put before the poets a garbled version of Chaucer's poetry, which inaccurately read, started jarring upon the ear. His followers misread and miscopied Chaucer. Their own poetry shows a lamentable neglect, if not ignorance, of all the basic law of prosody. Lydgate was the most injurious offender in his respect, and was frank enough to admit, "I took none heed neither to short nor long." Shelton and Hawes were other notable offenders. The former indeed admitted that his rhyme and raised and jagged. In his contempt of all verbal music, he might have given a cue of Donne and his fellow metaphysical. All the three principal meter employed by Chaucer, namely the heroic couplet and octosyllabic couplet with four stress in each line, and the Chaucerian stanza, were widely employed by the poets of the 15th century. But one of them exhibited in his handling of these measures the easy facility and forced mastery of Chaucer. Let us now discuss briefly the work of more important English Scottish Chaucerian in 15th century. English Chaucerians, the first, Thomas Occleve or Hocleve, 1317 to 1450. A consistent follower of Chaucer, he represents himself as the stupid scholar and excellent master. "My dear master, God his soul quite, and fodder Chaucer, fan old have and taught, but I was dull and learned light and not. Occleve was a satirist and moralist, but his most refreshing contribution to English poetry is the addition of autobiographical touch. A.C. Ward calls him, in inverted comma, one of England's earliest biographers, in order to come close. His main autobiographical work is La Mala Reglande, L-A-M-A-L-E, R-E-G-L-E-D-E. T. Occleve, which is of the nature of a confessions. The poet describes how debauched he was as a young man when he used to visit the taverns in Westminster. He gives some vivid picture and of the London of those times. His chief works as a poet, however, in his verse translation, in Chaucer's rhyme roll of Egidius de Regmine Principum, D-E-R-E-G-I-M-N-E-P-R-I-N-I-C-I-P-U-M. Regimen of Prince in English, written for the guidance of Prince Henry, who later became King Henry V. In his tone of earnest didacticism, Occleve is nearer moral jobber than his acknowledged master Chaucer. The second, John Lygatte, Lydgate, 1317 to 1449. He is the dullest and the most voluminous of English Chaucerians. Campton Rickard suggests that Occleve's confessional word in inverted comma, "but I was dull," inverted comma close, "but have been uttered by the lazard," also the we may suggest with greater appropriateness. He follows mostly the tradition of allegorical and the dream poetry we have already referred to. His poetic work extends run to more than 13,000 lines. We wonder why he was not included by the Pope among his dullard in the Dunciad. He has no ear for music and violates egregiously even the basic principle of prosody. Nor does he have the spirit of magic touch which Chaucer brought to bear upon his work. However, in their heyday, his principal works, the Troy books of the story and Thebes, the Falls of Prince, and the Pilgrims of the Life of Man, sometimes like Pilgrim's Progress, pleased numerous readers. He complained of the Black Knight was once ascribed to Chaucer. His most lively and the least dull work is his London Lackpenny, which describes the woes of a poor man in the street of London. Modern investigators have, however, come to the conclusion that this work was in fact written by someone else. Lazaget was a Benedictine monk of no mean learning, but learning is no substitute for a real poetry. Louis pertinently questions whether his Benedictine ever had time to lift his eyes from his book and paper and lock and nature. Third, Stephen Hawes, 1475 to 1525. He belongs to a later generation than Lazaret and Occleve, A.C. Watts observed about him. He looked upon himself as a follower of Chaucer, though he was in fact a blatant medievalist, using verse as a medium of sermonical allegories, uneasily wedded to chivalrous romance. He had a wonderful memory and could recite the work of many poets. He admired Lydgate too, that refers to him as my master. His most important work was the Pastime of Pleasure, Pastime of Pleasure, or the History of Grande Amour, Grande Amoure, and La Belle Pucelle, Pucel, which appeared at the end of the 15th or the beginning of the 16th century. It is Chaucerian more in prosody than in spirit or context. How use no doubt rhyme royal and decasyllabic couplet, but his odd intention in the training of a perfect knight and lover with the help of a narration of which allegorical struggle with Kent and the monster Spencer, as Ward ever was definitely indebted to Stephen Hawes, for it is evident that the Fairy Queen does perfectly what Hawes had tried to ponderously failed to do. On the other hand, it is no longer seriously held that Hawes' Pastime of Pleasure was widely influential of making of Spencer masterpiece. Fourth, Alexander Berkeley, 1474 to 1552. He is best known for his translation of the work of German poet Sebastian Brandt, which is entitled The Ship of Fool. The translation was not direct, but through the medium of a Latin and a French translation. He described the various personified vessels which make voice in a ship. He satires the voice of the clergy and the laymen alike, but his keenest satire is reserved for the voice of injury, workless name is also notable in the history of English literature for his introduction of a new genre and eclogue. He wrote some 5 eclogues, but he followed not Virgil but Montanus. As Lewis observed, his eclogues have nothing of the ideal IDYLL but are moral satires. 5th, John Skelton, 1460 to 1529. He is best known for his Quarse, Corase, and Pungent, Pungent satires, which put one in mind more of Langland than Chaucer. His verse are rough, unchiseled, and unmusical. He himself wrote, "Thou my rhyme beragged, tattered and jagged, ruddly ran beaten, rusty and moth eaten. If I taken well therewith, it hath in it some pith." This pith is generally very lively and mordant satire, which has for its target very often the clergy. He is perhaps the only Chaucerian who experimented with new prosodical measures. He was a great scholar, but had, like Samuel Butler, a keen taste of grotesqueries in Colin Clout. He lashed the vices, vices, of clergy in "Why Come A Nor to Court." He displayed grit enough to attack that all-powerful Wolsey. "The Bow of Court" is an allegorical satire of the kind of the Sieve of Fools. It is just caused in rhyme royal of Chaucer's invention. Stokes's Chaucerians. It is pleasure passing from the English of the Scottish poetry of the 15th century. In fact, the 15th century is the most glorious period of old Scottish poetry. Scottish Chaucerian captured more effectively the spirit of Chaucer's poetry than their English counterparts. And what is still more creditable, they exhibited a keener sense of originality in their works. Their poetry is not retrogressive but progressive. Let us consider briefly the work of the most eminent Scottish Chaucerians. The first, James I of Scotland, 1394 to 1439. He is known for his King Quare, King's Books, which is wrote while in the captivity of English. It commemorates a romantic incident in his own life. It was at the age of 11 that the king was captured by the English to remain a prisoner in England for more than 18 years. During captivity, he once happened to have through his window a glimpse of the stunning beauty of Joan Beaufort, daughter of the Earl of Somerset. In his release in 1424, he was married to her. In his poem, he narrates the story of his love sincerely, no doubt, but not with the dramatic realism of Chaucer. He mixes much allegory with reality, and then there is the dream of the Chaucer's House of Fame, in which he is wafted to the place of Venus and consoled by Minerva. James uses the pentameter stanza of 7 lines with the rhyme scheme AB, AB, BC, C, which Chaucer first employed in this Troilus and Chrysidus, Troilus and Chrysidus. As James I, a king, had also used it, it came to be known as rhyme royal. Second, Robert Henryson, 1425 to 1500. He is best known for his Testament of Creside, Creseid, in which he recalls the conclusion of Chaucer's Troilus and Creseid. In Chaucer's poem, Creseid betrays Troilus for Diomed, Diomed, and Troilus dies heartbroken. Henryson keeps Troilus alive and makes Diomed betray an inconstant Cressides who is struck by leprosy and goes about begging. Troilus accidentally comes across her and without recognizing her gives her arm. But Cressides known who is and after he is gone fall up to the ground. But before dying writers her will bequeathing a ring of Troilus who later erect a tomb of marble grave. Above her grave, Henryson's poem is written in the same measure, rhyme royal, as Chaucer and shows the same correctness and musical quality as Chaucer's poem. His other important work comprised some 13 Aesopian, A-E-S-O-P-E-A-N, fable and a version of the Greek legend of Orpheus and Eurydice. 3rd William Dunbar, 1465 to 1530. He is more arresting figure than even Henryson. He is sometimes called the Chaucer of Scotland. And not unjustly, he is greatest British poet between Chaucer and Spenser. His poems are usually sought mainly of them. The Lewis observed are cast in a medieval frame. He lacks of the observation of Chaucer and Henryson. But he has to rate degree one never reached before him, the seldom since virtuosity of style and versification. He dazzles the eyes and ravishes the ear. Dunbar's works fall into three categories as follows. First, formal allegory. Second, comic and satirical verse. And third, religious poetry. The Golden Targe, T-A-R-G-E, is the best work of the first category and has been already referred to. Other such works are Thistle and the Rose, celebrating the marriage of James IV and Margaret Tudor, sister of Henry VII of England. The Beauty and the Prisoners, among the poems of the second category of the most prominent and the most characteristics of Dunbar, is The Dance of the Seven Deadly Sins. The poem is more full of grotesquery and macabre buffoonery, B-U-F-F-O-N-E-R-Y, than religious edification. It is indeed a weird extravaganza. Thirdly, there are many rhymes written by him. Fourth, Gavin Douglas, 1475 to 1522. He is well known for his two allegorical poems, The Palace of Honor and The King Heart, and his verse translation of Virgil. The former is written in intricate nine-line stanza and too obviously imitate Chaucer House to fame. The latter uses of eight-line stanza of The Monk's Tales. The only novelty of Douglas in his mixing the humor and pathos in his allegory, his translation of Virgil's Aeneid is in heroic couplet, but he is little worried about correctness or music. His words jar upon air very readily. His translation seems to be more of the nature of a parody than a translation. The English Ballads. Next chapter, The English Ballads. Introduction. Strictly speaking, the ballads has no place in the history of English literature. To treat of it as one of the literary forms, such as the epic, the ode, or the sonnet, is quite erroneous. The true ballad is lore, L-O-R-E, rather than what is known as literature. It had its origin and growth at a time before literature, or even the alphabet, become to be written and read to find the ballad by the side of such a literary genre as the epic and the sonnet is as disturbing as finding the prehistoric Ichthyosaur, E-I-C-H-T-H-Y-O-S-A-U-R, in the company of the other animal in a modern zoo. In Ichthyosaur has had its day and so has the ballads. The ballad dies when in literature comes, just as the ichthyosaur was extinct before the more highly developed form of form of life come to their own. The ballad fluoresces as long as means by the communication are wholly oral. The arrival of the alphabet and literature, written literature, is a herald of the death and the ballads. As the rest of the folk literature, those disseminations and preservation depends entirely on oral means. But what about the ballads written by the poets such as Rushdie, Coleridge and Scott? These ballads may be called literary ballads, but they are not ballads proper because they do not have folk origin, which is synonymous with a peculiar kind of anonymity. Origin of the ballad. We have emphasized above the folk origin of the true ballads, but when that is said, still there is need for clarification, and that the origin of the true ballads is shrouded in a nebula, and it more a matter of conjecture than the scientific demonstration. If we examine the etymology by the word ballad, we may be helped a little in the job of ascertaining the origin of the ballad. Let us see how the word ballad is derived from the word baller, which means to dance. What is exactly the connection between the ancient ballad art and dancing? This question takes the further backward of to the wider consideration of the origin and origin of all folk literature. One can easily recognize the universal human instinct for accompanying all regular bodily movement with vocal expression. This instinct is more clearly marked than regular bodily movement are being made by a group of people, but is to be seen even when a lonely individual is involved. Thus, a man singing in a bathroom, even as he is performing the job of cleaning his body with more or less regular movement, can be easily imagined. A group of men having at a log or reaping the harvest, or the women having together break almost invariably the involuntarily into ejaculation with a without meaning. Dancing, as will be readily granted, involve more regular bodily movements than anything else. Group dancing, practiced by the ancient communities to celebrate this or that festival, then must have come to be accompanied by vocal ejaculation, which latter must have assumed a more coherent shape. This is how folk literature and the ballad must have originated. Thus, the connections between dancing and the ballads has to be considered in this perspective. Authorship. So the ballad must be taken as a later and more sophisticated from the primitive communal song sung to the accompaniment of ritual dancing in celebration of some occasions. But no important point which has controversial need elucidation still, the one concerning the authorship of the old ballads. The question is, are these ballads the product of collective effort, or that the some particular individuals? It is even to the moot point, but there is another point and one allied to this one, about which there is no controversy, that the ballads, as it has some sophistication about it which is not shared by the communal song, requires for the conception of writing a kind of artistry, individual or communal. What strikes one about an ancient ballad so abundantly is its downright impersonality or anonymity. Know that the authorship of these ballads, which have survived the mutation of taste for numerous centuries, in determinable rather. It is so said by a school of critic, they did not have individual writer as their authors. The whole of the community is credited by these critics with the authorship of these ballads. They contend that a ballad, unlike a literary composition, is not written down by a writer once and for all, rather, on account of being transmitted down the generation by wholly oral means. It is modified by every new generation in accordance with its own predilection. Thus, the latest version of Ballards, even though highly different from its original one, it is to be considered as authentic and is the original. Jean Roy, J-E-A-N-R-O-Y, Abercrombie and Child. For example, Favour, F-A-V-O-U-R, this view which emphasized the impersonality to the Ballards, ascribing to it communal rather than individual authorship. But this view could sound fundamentally at air to an extreme and has now been wholly discarded. Lewis point out in inverted comma, it has even been supposed that a Ballard is a spontaneous and joint composition of the group of people. Reflection shows, however, that is theory has little plausibility. There could be agreement for the purpose of poetry among a number of people only in sharing of a passion, and the work of an artist, of several successive artists, has to be recognized in a ballad of any length. It was artist, however primitive, who interpreted the multitude. We may agree with F.J. Child that so far as a ballad is concerned, the author counts for nothing. But we cannot say that Ballard has no definite author or authors. A Ballard is impersonal in one sense only, namely that the personality of its author or authors is of little importance in understanding and interpreting it. It expresses the personality not of an individual but of a community. The author never uses personal pronouns, nor does he reveal his personality by comments on the action for characters. Still, he does account for something. Stylistic and other conventions. A Ballard is always a narrative which is told in a particular way in accordance with some convention, as a narrative in generally confine itself to a single episode. In this respect, it is easily distinguished from an epic which covers a plethora of episodes spread over a number of years. A Ballard, though narrative, is often dramatic in effect, for it has that condensation which is peculiar to drama and not the sprawling diffuseness of the epic, whose material would, as Aristotle says, suffice for a number of tragedies. The Ballard, to quote a critic in a noted comma, sought, S-O-U-G-S-T, to impress by the vivid representation of a single event, to bring home to the hearer its wonder, its pathos, its fatefulness, or its horror. As it was oral literature, in bracket, something to be sung and heard rather than written and read, in bracket close, it depends for its emotional effect upon music. The refrain sung by the chorus was its peculiar feature. The singer, after having sung a few lines, was followed by the chorus singing the refrain. The refrain is the more frequent occurrence in the continental ballads than the English, because the latter were generally of the chronicle type, in which the narrative did not allow to frequent interruptions. Apart from the regular refrain, frequent receptions are also a common feature of the ancient ballad. Such receptions, dexterously handled, make for a peculiar intensification of emotional effect rather than simple embellishment of style. Note of use of reception in the following lines from Clark Saunders. Is there any room at your head, Saunders? Is there any room at your feet? Or any room at your side, Saunders, where fain I would sleep? There's no room at my head, Margaret. There is no room at my feet. My bed, it is full lowly now. Among the hungry worms I sleep. The pathos of these lines does not need any comment. The style of the ancient ballads is altogether down to earth, absolutely free from literary ornament, attitudinization, attitudinization, for empty bow, its very simplicity and directness, or its intrinsic strength. Even such a sophisticated man of letter and Renaissance England as Sir Philip Sidney was compelled to pay a special tribute to the rude strength and simple directness of old English ballad. Writing in this apology for poetry about the ballad of G.V. Chase, he confided that his heart was moved by it more than with a trumpet. And Joseph Addison, the sophisticated Mr. Spectator, writing in the Augustan age, was also full of admiration for the same qualities of this ballad. As regard meter and versification also, the ballad has the quality of simplicity and directness. A ballad follows one of the several traditional stanzaic per pattern. The more usual ballad stanza consists the four line of 8 and 60 syllables alternately. The second and the fourth line generally rhyme, and the lines usually follow the iambic movement, but variation are not infrequent. Themes of the most ballads are provided by the more usual human passion in their intense and unsophisticated form, such as love, lust, hate and jealousy. As most ancient ballads are the product of basically pagan event, the nominally Christian culture, very few of them in bracket such a Divas and Lazarus bracket close have religious the biblical theme. One third of them are about love. Quite a few of them are frankly about the supernatural, such as evil spirit, mermaids, mermaids, gods, and even the devil himself. Thus, in the Demon Lover, we have the account of the beautiful woman betrayed by an evil spirit who come to her in shape of a handsome man. Some of the ballad indulging in the supernatural keep thing, shrouded in mystery, but still strike the reader with a sense of wonder. Thus, in James Harris, we meet a woman who, in the absence of her husband for 7 years, marries a carpenter, but is lured by an evil spirit who appears to her in guise of her presumably dead husband. And so together away they went from off the English shore. Where they went and with what consequence, and even why, are questions left completely unanswered. Love and strong but baser human passion provide the usual theme for most ballads. The proverbial jealousies of stepmother, the cruelty of brother, usually 7 in number, of the woman who desire the love of a man against their wishes, the trickery of a confidant, etc., are to be met with quit often in old ballads. In Clerk Saunders, the lover is killed while asleep by sight of heroine by her 7 brothers. She finds him murdered only when she gets up next morning. In Young Hunting, the strong-minded heroine kills her lover after becoming convinced of his infidelity, but he comes in the form of a bird of revel, the murder. In The Cruel Sister, we have a sister who kills another out of sheer revelry. Babylon is the story of an outlaw who tries to make love to 2 sisters and kill them both. On being rejected, he learns that they are his own sister and then kills himself. A number of ballads called the border ballads deal with the English-Scottish skirmishes on the border between England and Scotland, bringing out the bravery of the heroes on both sides. Another group of ballads, some 30 in number, called Robin Hood ballad, deal with the exploits of the kinds of generous outlaw named Robin Hood and its followers who believed in a mind of socialism. Robin Hood is represented as the friend of poor and enemy of the rich, of whom he robs for the sake of the farmer. He is patriot but does not scruple to live on the king's deer. He rescues women being married to the groom they had to restore them to their sweetheart. He corrects the wrong justice by hanging the sheriff and rescuing the man wrongly condemned, and so on. Chapter closed.